logs, and they I think they cover the period of 1885 to 1915. I think he himself was probably born in the 1890s. I think he died in the 60s while working on the project. He didn't finish it. In a way, it doesn't matter if it's finished because there's so many little hunks. Well, what he did was he went through all this material, and then from what he found there, he distilled them into these very terse prose poems. It's incredibly sad, and of course, because of the source of this material, everything ends badly, sometimes in a severe way, other times in very mild ways, which is startling, especially after you've seen these things that end in people's deaths. You see one that doesn't end with any violence, but it still, reveals something really awful about human nature or some awful thing somebody did. And yet, for something that unrelenting and bleak, it didn't leave me feeling depressed. He's so good. It's a startling thing to read because you peer into the lives of people who've long been gone, who were not known and long forgotten, whose lives are, entirely obscured and lost to history. And yet he dug up this stuff, and by doing this distilling of it like that, it really does honor the people whose lives he's peering into. And how, of course, the title comes from, it's their testimony, as in court testimony. I didn't even think till later of it's that, in effect, it's his testimony to them and these lives that would have been buried in these tragedies. And it's just so revealing about human nature, and yet it's so dry the way he's written it. It's so dry, and you just see it unfold. I mean, one of them, the one that I really remember with any clarity, was one about a passenger on a train, and he falls asleep and misses his stop, and the conductor wakes him up and is berating him and scolding him for not having gotten out at his stop, but he won't allow him to ride to the next stop to change and go back. He stops the train and makes him go out in between stations in the dark, and he doesn't know what to do. And the conductor says, "You see that light over there? You're like, that's the station house. Just go over there." And so, and then the train leaves, and he's stumbling in the dark, only to then discover that the light is, in fact, the light of an approaching train coming towards him. But I do recommend reading it. It's really good. It's really good. Well, I love reading things that are really good. And I get to. I'm glad there's such a backlog of books that are so good that you can't even get to all of them. So you're not hurting for good stuff. So let's get back to the theme of history. Well, that's a really good example of a kind of a history that I'm into because it's so personal. Well, what it chronicles is something that, isn't really chronicled in ordinary histories. I mean, I guess it is, but it had such a purpose behind it that is hard to define. And it'll just have to suffice to say it's driven by a human purpose. So in my case, I love co collecting this stuff. And, there's certain ones that are well known that I love, but I'm especially excited about the off the beaten path things. Well, it's funny because sometimes people will define something as obscure knowledge, obscure material. Well, of course, that's a temporal attribute. Doesn't define the music at all. Something that's obscure now will become famous in the future or so well known, people will be sick of it, and it's a war horse, and then they'll make fun of it and have contempt of it because it's too commonplace. Or things like that that are too commonplace then become obscured later after having been, oh, I wish I remembered it well enough that, getting back to Lichtenberg, one of his friends, contemporary, said, and he cited some author whose name I don't know, I think it was Jean-Paul something, or Jean-Paul, I don't know his name, but let's say it was that. He said, I would rather be forgotten with Lichtenberg than to be immortal with Jean-Paul, who was the fashionable writer of the day. Now we don't know who he is, but we got Lichtenberg. But I thought, that's the best compliment ever. I'd rather be forgotten with this wonderful, substantial person than be immortal with somebody who's full of baloney. But people feel that things from even just the previous or one or two generations, that it's something out of reach or becomes remote or exotic. And of course, the further back you go, the more remote and exotic it can feel, because it's beyond your own time, beyond the reach of your own experience. Thank you. But I like for something to be presented without any sort of scrim of what gets between you and the thing, and not define it as being old. It is old. It feels remote. But if you can help for people to regard it without that interim blocking, you know, getting in your way, getting in between. I don't know if you ever saw the Mike Leigh film Topsy Turvy. I love his films. You know, he does a lot of improvisation with actors to come up with the script. Very peculiar films. Very good, I think. Well, Topsy Turvy is about Gilbert and Sullivan. Well, I was never really ape for Gilbert and Sullivan. Also, I only really kind of know of it through an American lens or American Gilbert and Sullivan fans. But the Mike Leigh film, to me, is a very interesting period piece. Takes place in, I guess, the 1870s. But he has the opposite aspiration as many people depicting that era, in that he makes you feel like you're spying on people in their present time. And I felt like that was what he wanted to do. He didn't want it to be in the least bit romantic or have a romanticized vision that even exaggerates the differences of that world. He was trying to minimize the differences. So even as you look at some detail that throws into harsh relief the difference between their world of assumptions and ours, you really felt like you were seeing people that this is, you see their norm, what is a norm for them. He really puts you up as close to it and makes it more prosaic. That's what I love about it. In a way, it was more poetic because he made it, tried to depict it in as prosaic a way as he could, that you had the texture of ordinary day-to-day life, and that there was nothing exotic in the slightest, even as something is, you know, for instance, there's a well-known scene where I think Arthur Sullivan is calling somebody on a telephone, the newfangled thing, and he's shouting into it because, you know, you can not really be heard. And then his aged father, who's contemptuous of this newfangled thing in the house and making fun of him for yelling into it, he says, "Why don't you just open the window and shout down the street?" And he also gives you a sense of the precariousness of life, and particularly then. But, and a lot of times something doesn't happen, but you see how something is ready to happen and that there's a disaster. One of the actors is in his dressing room and he's like shooting up some kind of cocaine solution and people don't know about it. They're like, you're on in a few minutes. He's like, oh, okay, I'll be there. And he goes and he's all messed up, but he's out on the stage and the other performers know that he is in bad shape and is not steady on his feet. And you're waiting for the whole thing to wipe out in front of everybody. And you're seeing everyone close up on the stage and you see the crazy stage makeup and the edge of a bald wig. And then you see it from the audience and they're far away and you can't see any of the exaggeration of the stage makeup at all. And then you're back, you know, seeing the beads of sweat on the grease paint. But the way they played it too, it was very grave in a way. I thought, does Mike Lee have like more contact with what the feeling or the tone of Gilbert and Sullivan was? Because I always thought of it as kind of silly, light comic opera. But the way they perform it is odd. And I kind of wondered, is that Mike Lee's slant or is he closer to the tradition? Either way, it was great. And the performances were weird. And the singing was beautiful. But I admired how he treated the period. And his empathy for the people of that period. And another person might have made fun of them for being old-fashioned. He wasn't making fun of anybody.
Can I ask how you came to leave New York and move up here?
Well, I knew there was no future in staying there because rents were going up. And I was still paying, way under market. But it was always going to go up. I had been in the same apartment for 18 years. Most of the time I was in that one place. And it was a great place. So I was lucky. I had this wonderful place all those years. But I started to look elsewhere in the neighborhood, but, you know, there wasn't anything. And I was still, you know, living in the past. It was a 3-bedroom apartment. Well, it had started out as $1,000 a month and really remained that way for most of the time. I always had a fantasy of eventually being able to take over the whole apartment. But that was never within my reach. It was never within my reach to have a separate studio from my apartment. I was fortunate to have use of the basement, which didn't officially belong to anyone. And I, you know, installed some electricity down there and made some room, and I had a kind of a wood shop set up. So I was fortunate that I could do all my woodworking there. I never really did woodworking, very little, until 89. And that was when I made the zither with the little jigsaw. Didn't have a table saw yet. Well, I got a table saw. Then I started making some other stuff. I made a record jacket for They Might Be Giants for their second record. Well, at that point, I shared the apartment with one of them, John Linnell, and my girlfriend, Clea. And originally, they were going to get somebody else to do the cover. They were going to get the cartoonist Charles Burns, but something bottomed out with the deal. And then they asked me, like, make one of your things, because I made these little kind of architectural sculptures, these shrine things. Well, that was something I started out as a collaboration with my friend from Lexington, John Hardy. For New Year's, we started making these little constructions for a New Year's party that had some sort of a, you know, magic elixir that you would partake of at the midnight hour, which you could tell by a clock built into this little edifice that had some electricity and some lights in it. So we did that together for 3 years, and then I kept doing it myself over the years, until very recently, I only stopped doing that. So in a way, I kind of got my start with woodworking with John Hardy. He lives in Gloucester, Mass. He and his wife run a bakery there. I haven't seen him in years, but I did just talk to him a couple days ago. He sent an email for my birthday, which was yesterday. So, I got into the woodworking through John back when we both, you know, our families were still in Lexington, and used some tools, you know, his father's basement, that were his dad's. I think I even started using that little, you know, kitchen egg beater style saw then. So, and then that was also around the time, I guess maybe it was 1984, I was still a college student, but spent a semester in New York in 84. And I did some internships. One was with the video artist Dara Birnbaum, who was a very interesting character. I remember, you know, her stuff was very much couched in theory. It was kind of presented as theoretical work. What I was intrigued by was that I felt it was really intuitive work, but in a way was kind of presented as theory. But I thought what was going on that wasn't accounted for by theory was what really made it, gave it its spark. But that was also an era where it was probably, you know, not cool to be intuitive. You had to be a theorist. Well, then, you know, fashion, intellectual fashion, is another funny, fascinating thing, because it has to do with thronging, and it has to do with irrational forces. It has to do with people being moved by a feeling of belonging. And it is capricious, and it changes over time. You know, the composer Ligeti, Hungarian composer, I read some wonderful interviews with him from the early 70s, where he was talking about his aversion to, you know, being in with whatever the intellectual fashion is, and he just wanted to do his thing. And he said, everyone wants to be in the egg. I thought it was a wonderful and very concise turn of phrase. I loved the way he talked about his own work, too. It seemed as though he were kind of arriving at it as he was talking about it. He would talk about a piece he wrote and compared it to clouds forming and then dissolving. He said, it's not supposed to represent that. It's not program music. But I can't help but to have these visual comparisons and analogies, images. And then he talked about that and then concluded, my music is program music without the program. I also, what he loved what he said about electronic music. As a young man in the late 40s, he'd heard all about electronic music. It excited his imagination. He heard about how you could create any sound in the lab. But he hadn't heard electronic music, really. Just heard about it. Then he got set up in Cologne in the 50s at the Electronic Music Laboratory. He was disappointed to find out that you couldn't make any sound, that any sound you wanted, and that the equipment was primitive, as far as he was concerned. And he made three pieces, all of which I think are great, and then abandoned it. He said, but it was a valuable experience for me because it changed the way I thought about the orchestra. So now when I write for the orchestra, I just use the orchestra the way I would have used the electronic music laboratory. I loved that. I love his music. I had a teacher at Oberlin, a composer named Joe Wood. I loved him. He was so, and he was unappreciated, which was so crazy and stupid. I had another teacher who was one of the younger teachers, and I studied electronic music with him, and I'm still friends with him. He lives in New York. He teaches at Juilliard now. His name is Conrad Cummings. And, you know, he was wonderful. He was a great teacher, very generous person, generous to everyone. I remember he said about Joe Wood, yeah, I think he's the saltiest guy here. I remember he appreciated him. Young people just thought of him as the old fogey modernist or something. He wasn't part of the new generation of other guys who I didn't really connect to. Also, I didn't feel like I don't want to cast aspersions or anything, but I just felt like I felt much more tuned into Joe Wood and his cantankerousness. But he was also more informal, more organic of a teacher than the other teachers, who I think he started out as being totally permissive, and then they were not happy that they felt like their students weren't applying themselves, and then they were trying to get tough and made them keep a log of how many hours they composed and all sorts of stuff that Joe Wood never made me do. Well, I remember the first time I brought in a score. I don't know how old he was. He was about to retire. He was in his 70s. He was a two-pack-a-day guy. I went to the end of a dark corridor that ended with his door and this poster with this grumpy-looking cartoon frog who addresses the viewer. He's smoking a cigarette and he says, "To hell with the Surgeon General. I like to smoke, so don't bother me." I'd knock on his door and he'd say, "Come in!" And I'd come in and he'd say, "What do you got?" And I would show him something I had. Well, first, the first thing I brought in was a score, and one of the instruments was an electric guitar. He didn't even want to look at it. He just threw it on the desk and said, "Guitar! Twang! Twang!" But, and it was funny, I told this story recently to my friend Bobby Previtt. He's a drummer. He's been a downtown music scene guy for years. He's more than a decade older than me. Very funny person and full of energy. You know, he's played a lot with John Zorn and other people of that ilk. I play with him now in a band of his. He lives up here. He and his wife, Andrea Klein, who's a writer. Actually, she did a wonderful theater piece. Bobby Previtt was performing in it as an actor. I thought it was great. What she did was weird and subtle. Well, that's a whole other story. So I told Bobby just that part without even ever telling him anything else. He said, "Wow, what a great teacher." Well, it's funny because I feel like, well, Joe Wood sent me to listen to all kinds of music that was all different from each other, certainly very different from his own stuff. So I admired he was a person who didn't just want to teach you to do his bag. Conrad Cummings told me about his teacher who made his reputation on, non-traditional use of the instrument, you know, playing the cello down below the bridge or knocking on it or whatever. But when he was a student with him, he said he and the other students were, he felt kind of oppressed by that they had to do their teacher's thing. And they referred to the non-traditional use of instruments as instrument fucking. And he said he'd bring a piece to his teacher and he'd say, "Well, that's a very nice piece, Conrad, but where is your extended instrumental technique?" So it was funny to hear these anecdotes, always without any editorializing from Conrad, about how people make their reputation on their avant-garde thing, which then ossifies into a form of oppressive conservatism. And at one point, I remember him saying to me, and this is long after he quit Oberlin, I think he got a tenured position, which took some doing, and then decided he was done with it and split, came to New York. Well, he did a bunch of other stuff before he went back to teaching at Juilliard. I'm glad he's teaching because I think he has such a gift for teaching and such a gift for getting all the problems out of the way that impede people from learning, all the anxiety. He was good at addressing the realities of the human organism and clear that out of the way so people can do something worthwhile. I could feel how all the other students appreciated that without even knowing what was going on, without knowing what hit them. Sometimes people would even make fun of him for being Mr. Rogers. But it's so funny because, you know, they were young people trying to show that they weren't a baby. Oh, Mr. Rogers. And everyone liked to make fun of Mr. Rogers in that era on Saturday Night Live and everywhere else. Of course, later, as I got to know more about Fred Rogers, the more I admired him greatly. You know, besides having a music degree, he was he had a degree in psychology and was an ordained minister. But I heard him on the radio in the late 70s, which was sort of the height of Make Fun of Mr. Rogers, and a local Boston DJ at WBCN was calling this number at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you'd hear this phone ringing, and he'd say, like, "We've got Mr. Rogers' phone number. How am I going to convince the listening audience this is the real Mr. Rogers, not an impersonator?" So, at some still very early hour, the phone picks up, and you can tell it is the real Mr. Rogers. The DJ was so obnoxious to him, so disrespectful. Mr. Rogers was like a jiu-jitsu master. he just took all of this crap and was always civil to him, never competed with him, understood the terrain, outmaneuvered him, but always with grace and kindness. And this guy was such a prick. It was horrible. But the guy, you could tell that he realized he had met his match, and he backed off. And it was so interesting to see this guy thinking he's going to wipe his feet all over him. And then he was, you know, in this inverted way, like he lost the fight from somebody who would not deign to fight with him. And I thought, wow, that's power. Many years later, I saw him on the Jay Leno show. It was similar. The audience is ready to treat him as a figure of fun, as like the gentle person who can be run over for sport. And then he turned them all around in his way. He's sitting in the upholstered interview chair. And at the end of the interview, you hear this offstage piano start an intro. And he's not getting up on a soundstage. He's still in the chair. And he turns to the camera and addresses the camera and starts singing, "When You're Feeling Sad and Blue, da 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 da." And the audience went wild, and he won them over. And it was so funny to see him do that again, turn it around, and how unfazed he was and long used to this. Very interesting character. I heard about how the artist Fred Grooms, you know, somebody was trying to get him to work with or appear on a Mr. Rogers episode. And at the time, he was still establishing his thing and kind of didn't want to just be thought of as something for kids, which he could have easily, you know, been shunted into. But I think he did meet up with Mr. Rogers and he got into it. And I think, you know, once he met him, he saw what he had going for him and admired what he did, admired his endeavor. I had the pleasure of working with Red Grooms for about a week. At the end of my internships in New York, I worked for Derek Birnbaum. I worked for the Collective for Living Cinema in Tribeca. I drew a bunch of posters for them, including a reusable one that showed a picture of a 16mm projector projecting on a screen, and then the blank area on the screen you could write whatever the show was in. And it was funny, later when I moved to New York, sometime in the, like 10 years later, they were still using that same poster. I think all the original people that had been there were gone, but they were still using the poster, which I thought was so funny. And then I ended up, at the end of it, they were trying to hook me up with Red Grooms, who was right in the neighborhood, and I left some notes on his door. And so the week after that semester was over, I did go to work on a crew of people who were making a big sculpture that was called Cortland Alley. So he reproduced this whole alley, and you walk down, you know, between these buildings. Like, you remember once somebody, there was a lot of carved foam. They would carve things out of, with those electric knives that people use to slice Thanksgiving turkeys. And they were using those to sculpt and cut foam and then paint the foam. And somebody made a foam pigeon, put on the foam cornice. And somebody took a paintbrush with some white paint on it and shook it at the cornice and splatted it with white to look like pigeon shit. And then Red Grooms came in and saw it. And he said, "Oh, I like that." He was wonderful, too. He was wonderful to work with. Very easygoing person. The last day I worked there, I was sick. That's right, I was staying at a place and I was locked out. I didn't have keys and I couldn't call in because the flimsy light phone didn't have enough weight to hang itself up on its button. You know, no cradle. It just sits on a surface. So I couldn't get in. It was the beginning of January. So I remember getting into some building and kind of sleeping in a stairwell or on a landing. But, you know, eventually, you know, it was very cold in there. And I ended up going to the subway and kind of riding the subway, sitting up but being kind of asleep. And by the time I showed up for work in the morning, I was sick. And I came in there, like one of the first things I did was have to, you know, go into the bathroom and throw up. And so I lay down on the couch and I slept pretty much the whole day on the couch. And at the end of the day, Red handed me a check. I said, "Oh, you don't have to pay me for today. All I did was lie on your sofa and puke." And he said, "Oh, well, take it anyway. I'm glad you came in." And I remember showing him some drawings that I had made. And in a way, they were drawings of objects. He said, "You should make these." At the time, I just thought, like, well, I can't make those. But just him saying that gave me this encouragement. Well, that was probably the first New Year's shrine that John Hardy and I did together, because I drew a picture, but it didn't occur to me to actually make it. And John and I had already done some sort of New Year's ritual thing just by pulling some benches together and making this altar piece, but we didn't make something yet out of wood. It was just a thing that we pulled together. So it's just so funny to think of how just that these little, very little encouragements can change the trajectory of your life, and they're so haphazard. You know, I think of, there's so many things like that. Well, when I read this wonderful book of writings by the composer Morton Feldman, and I read his writing before I heard his music, I read the book and I thought, I love this guy. I was afraid that the music might not live up to the strength of his prose. But I heard his music, and I loved his music. I thought, all those things he said when he's speaking about people that he admires, that's certainly true of himself. He said, one of the things I loved that he wrote was, "Ives, Verrez, and Cage are often passed over as iconoclasts. Another word for unprofessional. If you do something original or innovative, you're an amateur. You're imitators. These are the professionals." Well, his writing is full of all kinds of wonderful tidbits. I love the things that concern him. The candidness and the funniness of his writing. And he's very acerbic often, but not always. And his music is very different. And he's famous for the contrast for being this very, very big, burly, brash, humorous, chain-smoking, thick glasses-wearing, greasy-haired guy. But his music is very transparent and quiet and beautiful and long-form. The thing that fascinates me about him as an artist is how these pieces are very long, but there is no tedium. You listen to them, and at first it doesn't really seem like anything. It's very simple. It's funny because it's kind of homely, too, but it's very beautiful. It's beautiful, but through these very homely means. And after a while, your sense of time goes out the window, and it's really kind of hypnotizing and bewitching. And then I think, how is he doing this? He's barely doing anything, and yet it's so captivating. And for such a long time, and because he makes your sense of time go out the window, there's never tedium or boredom or discomfort. And it's always metamorphosing, and it's so gentle. And it's really just because he is very judicious. And there really isn't, he's wonderfully unsystematic in his approach. And he writes about how it bugs him that composers are obsessed with mastery and control and demonstrating how they're in controlling everything and all these rational systems, which he thinks of as, like, you know, not what he's into. He identified with painters rather than composers. He felt like what he wanted to do with music was more like painting, or what painters did. He loved the abstract expressionists. He was pals with a bunch of them. But he wrote that painters had a culture where they were freer to be subjective. And it was that subjective, mysterious thing in art that was interesting to him. He's addressing a public about a piece of his. He says, "There's one thing I don't like about it. It was idea-oriented." Which I got a kick out of, that he saw that as a flaw. But I love his music, I love his writing, his thought. So it's always so funny to see how he feels about the people that bug him. He has a chip on his shoulder about all sorts of people. And then the people that he loves, the people he admires. He's also critical of the people that he admires, but it doesn't diminish his admiration. My teacher, Joe Wood, was like that about John Cage, who came to Oberlin in 1984 and gave a concert. It was a retrospective, so it started with early pieces from the 30s all the way up to his brand new 1984 piece, you know, which was a conceptual piece with like four orchestras in each corner of the hall. There was a reception later, and, you know, everyone's clamoring around Cage. Joe Wood and I are off in a corner. We wanted to go to the reception, but we didn't have anything to say to Cage that he could use. And he's busy with all these people worshiping him because he's a big cheese in 1984. And Joe Wood said to me, he was probably about the same age as Cage. He said, "The man is a tremendous talent, a tremendous talent. But really, there was no excuse for that last piece." So I loved the way he was unequivocal in his admiration of him as a great artist, but that he did not care for his new piece, and probably generally didn't care for conceptual pieces. I kind of had the idea that everything after the 60s he hated. He hated Philip Glass, he hated minimalism. Anything with verbatim repetition of any kind bugged him. It bugged him in Debussy. You know, you repeat a phrase verbatim, you say, "Oh, why did he do that?"
How do you think he'd feel about Duanatrons?
I don't know. I bet he would have gotten a kick out of it or found it whimsical. He probably wouldn't be that interested in a compositional point of view. I don't really know. I don't even know how he felt about electronic music. It's so funny. And yet, I wish I had been in touch with him over the years. I saw him after he retired when I was still a student. He saw me on the street. He said, "I thought you graduated." I said, "Well, I've got one more year, so I'm still around." He said, "Yeah, still around. Oh, the same thing goes for me, too." And then he told me about how he'd had a stroke and how it freaked him out. And he described the sensation of it his coming up on him. Well, luckily, I wouldn't have been able to tell he had a stroke because he was walking around and he didn't have any difficulty. And at that point, I probably didn't even know anything about strokes. Didn't know anyone who ever had a stroke. And he quit smoking after being a two-pack-a-day guy for however many years, you know, 50 years. I said to him, "Well, that's impressive to quit cold turkey after all those years." And he just raised his hand in a dismissive gesture and said, "No, I was scared, so I stopped." Like, no, it wasn't difficult. You know, that was the wake-up call, and he just quit, and that was that, and it wasn't difficult. And I never saw him after that, and I didn't know how much longer he lived. Of course, I remembered him seeming very old. Of course, now I wouldn't think of it as so old. Although, you know, he was pretty wizened in a certain way, or now when people get to that age, they're less ground down, and there's better medical and all that. But I remember, I don't know what year it was, when I read his obituary in the Alumni magazine. It was written by his daughter, Lorna Wood, who I never met but heard about because she was my age and she was an Oberlin student. I heard about her through a guy named Stuart Freeberg in the creative writing department, and she described her as a strange creature, which didn't surprise me because knowing her dad, if she was a chip off the block, and not knowing anything about her mother, you know, he was just such a funny person. and also I remember playing a piece for him. And he liked it. He said, "Oh, this is very, very attractive stuff." But then there was a middle section where he teetered his hand back and forth and said, And I realized, yeah, he was right. That part was kind of weak. This new part works much better to the rest of it. And I played it for him, and he said, "Yeah, yeah, 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 yeah."
That's a good compliment.
Yeah. Well, what was funny was I remember it was probably the last day I had a class with him. I gave him a picture I drew. It was called Pope Mobile. They had this kind of extravagant car and a kind of abstracted figure on a throne in a kind of mod ecumenical style almost. And I remember he was so startled by it. He said, "I didn't know you could do this." And he thought that I was an organ major or something, or that I was a conservatory student, and I wasn't. I was a college student, and I ended up being an art major, studio art, but I also got to study music at the conservatory. So I got to study organ, electronic music, and composition. I remember taking Theory 1 when I was a freshman, and I failed. My friend Ray Wakeland, who I knew from Oberlin, said, "Brian, how could you fail Theory 1? It's trivially easy." Well, I knew the stuff, but the way the teacher gave the test, well, half the class flunked, because you had a piece of paper with a bunch of unnumbered blanks in rows, and he had a metronome on a music stand in the front of the room, and it would go tick, 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 back and forth, and he'd say, 5 flats, 7 sharps, 2 sharps, 3 flats, 7 flats, and then you had to name the relative minor of that key signature. So once you blew one space, you were disoriented and couldn't get back on the track. So if you blew some, you didn't just blow them, you blew the whole thing. And he didn't want to teach Theory 1 because he wanted to teach his trombone class. He was a trombone guy. And he was really, I felt rather cold to the students. I was surprised when I actually showed him something that I wrote, a score, and he looked at it, and he was kind of moved and really was excited, and then showed friendliness to me that he had never shown before. And he said, "Oh, you should study with the composer, and he steered me to Joe Wood. But I think he was also excited because I was writing tonal music, which in that period you weren't allowed to do. So he was glad to see a young person who wasn't getting with the program and writing serial music or what have you. Well, by the time I was a student, serial music was no longer the de rigueur thing. You still couldn't write tonal music, though. You had to make some conceptual piece or whatever. Or a percussion piece or whatever. But, you know, you couldn't write. And I wasn't interested in writing something they would have thought of as hokey, because what I liked was extended tonality. Something that was tonal, but that, you know, starts to stretch out into something that might even resemble something that people don't think of as tonal, and then it comes back. Well, I love Paul Hindemith's organ sonatas, and Paul Hindemith wrote some interesting stuff addressed to the student of composition. And he was wonderfully salty. Well, also, I think he pissed everybody off because he started teaching at the Bauhaus, and he was like a hot young avant-garde composer. But by the time he got there, he became a neoclassicist and wasn't interested in radical postures and just thought of that as a youthful indiscretion. And so now he wanted to write neo-Baroque music. But of course, you know, the tonality goes pretty out, but it's still like, you know, it starts on the triad, it ends on the triad. He writes, "The composer cannot depart from the triad for too long without completely confounding the listener." You know, the triad is a fact of nature. It is like the plumb line of gravity. If an architect were to build a building without regard for the plumb line of gravity and made a building with diagonal floors and walls, visitors would not tarry long in this interesting but useless structure. So, of course, I love things that, you know, you don't have to agree with it to get the idea and to appreciate where someone is coming from. I had an art teacher in high school. His name was Mr. Rom. He had been a medical illustrator in the Second World War. And so he was, you know, more of an older teacher. The young groovy teacher in the next room was teaching photography. Had a dark room in there, and he had a record player, and they were playing Beatles records. The door between the rooms was open. So Mr. Rom goes to shut the door to block the music out, but the kids are saying, "Oh, leave it open, I'd like to hear it." And he says, "Okay, but I don't know why you kids like all this disco stuff. The purpose of music is to soothe." And that stayed with me. I love things like that more than somebody who is trying to come up with some kind of comprehensive theory. So I can't help but to love those kinds of points of view. And I, it stayed with me. The purpose of music is to soothe. And I can dig it, even if that's not my purpose all the time. Plus, I love soothing music. Well, I remember when I was a kid, liking but feeling obligated to dismiss as fogey, you know, like string orchestra music, like Mantovani stuff, or stuff that you would hear on what was in that period called a beautiful music station, which was basically music. But that was also in the era when music was lush strings in reverberant halls. And so it was all about that kind of lushness. In fact, you know, looking back on it, you know, that was sort of like, people thought of it as an old lady station, and it sort of is like this relaxing drug. It functioned like a drug. It was like heroin for old ladies, you know, to make them calm and blissed out. And you'd have soothing announcers who would say, "You're listening to WSSH. Wish, your island in the sea of beautiful music." And then they would play the music. A lot of the music were arrangements of contemporary pop songs that weren't really appropriate to that instrumentation, which was always hilarious. You'd hear "Light My Fire" done with like pizzicato strings going pluck, 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 pluck. But I remember liking the station because of its drug-like soothingness. And it was considered this benign, innocuous thing for old ladies. Once again, the young dismissing the old for being old and not having any clue. The secret always from the young that elderly people are former young people and former reckless and blasphemous children who are destructive and don't know anything.
Brian, I want to talk about the Demonitrons.
Okay.
And what you're up to now.
Oh, gosh. Well, that started out with... you know, I think it was in 2002, my cousin Leon, who was working for a web company doing technical stuff for webs, HTML stuff, he offered to help me to put up a website. I said, great. But then we got distracted and started talking about synthesizers. Well, my friend Ken Johnston, who lives in Brooklyn, he lent me this homemade synthesizer that a friend of his made probably in 1980 or so. And it was this funny little kind of triangular shaped thing made out of a piece of scrap metal that had some funny square holes that he used to put round switches in and then drilled other holes. So it was a bunch of unmarked toggle switches and knobs. But when I looked, and he wanted, you know, he lent it to me and said, "This thing is cool, but you must promise me not to clean the pots." You know, that's short for potentiometer. "Don't clean them out because that's part of it. You know, the scratch, like I don't want to lose that. So don't clean it." So I didn't clean it. And I would sometimes get some sound out of it, but it was mysterious. I didn't know what was what. And sometimes in various combinations, it prevents something from happening. But sometimes I get these little sounds out of it. But I was mystified by it because inside there was this rat's nest of wires. But I didn't see any electronics, really. And I showed it to Leon because I had gotten sound out of it, but then I stopped being able to get sound out of it. And I wondered if, you know, because he knew electronics, if he might be able to fix it. Well, he looked at it and he couldn't fix it, but he saw that it had this chip that he recognized. He said, "Oh my God, it's the SN76477 chip." I said, "Oh, you know what that is? What's that?" And he said, "Oh, it was this chip that was made as a sound generating thing and that was made by Texas Instruments, and it was used in various video games." And, you know, in those days, video games were arcade machines with cathode ray tubes, or that defined the video game, where now that does not define the video game. So he said, you know, he bought one of these things from Radio Shack in 1978, but never did anything with it. So he found it and then, you know, wired it up and made a kind of primitive synth. And then I kicked in my two cents about some things, about the way it would operate. And then we began to talk more about synthesizers and about how, you know, now that they had become expensive, it would be nice to make something that would be too extravagant a thing to mass produce, but it's a non-issue when you're making a one-off. And I was talking to him about, you know, the satisfaction of tuning several oscillators, like 8 oscillators, to a single note that are slightly detuned. And then he went and, you know, made some oscillators, like some sawtooth generator oscillators, and a way to spread them out. But then he also thought, well, while you're spreading them out to detune them, you can just push them out over the whole spectrum and just drop a bunch of equally positioned notes. You know, the Moog synthesizer kind of operates that way with its keyboard, that you spread the notes out until you get an octave and a, you know, and 12 equal tempered tones, but you can also do it with any amount of tones or any per octave, and that you can adjust that, which is a modular Moog thing. So, and I was into the idea of, you know, that you can use graphite, like from pencils, as a resistor. And then he made a kind of a ribbon controller with a bunch of pencil squiggling, but then he got some Aquadag, which is a liquid that has graphite suspended in it. So then he put together what was the first kind of primitive Swarmatron. My friend David Shore, who I grew up with, I remember was talking about being interested in making music with swarms of sound with the guitar, multi-track, and not really use it like a guitar, but to make these swarms. And so we ended up making this thing that we called the Swarmatron. Well, we were making instruments just for ourselves, and with the idea, too, that you could make an instrument that rather than you make a multi-track recording like you traditionally did with synthesizers, you know, with one voice at a time. And, you know, Wendy Carlos, Walter Carlos, who made the music for Clockwork Orange, who made Switched on Bach. I remember reading an interview with Wendy Carlos about how making the Switched on Bach record, it was just supposed to be this record for audiophiles. And nobody had any idea that it would become a mainstream hit. It wasn't created to be a hit, but it was a hit. And how it was difficult, on the one hand, to have this unexpected success, but also to be in the middle of this transition, you know, and that was in a, you know, before anybody even thought about transgender stuff. So here's Wendy Carlos, like one of the earliest people to do it, and also talking about and saying, like, oh, ever since I was 3 years old, in my earliest memories, like, I always knew that I was a woman. So it was interesting that there was no ambivalence or conflict, just that was a cut and dry thing always in her life. And then making this so, you know, having listened to these records and admired them so much, these Moog records, rather than using that technique, we were trying to think of things that you could do something live with electronics that didn't require multi-tracking, but that was still extravagant. Well, we made an instrument. I've got the first one downstairs called the Dual Primate Console that we came up with. So the idea was two people face each other and have identical sets of controls, including some rotary telephone dials that you can dial in these numbers. I had wanted, you know, when my brother taught at a school, I remember there are these rotary dials in a machine. I wondered what it was because it wasn't a phone. It was a language lab machine, and you use the dial to access something in a computer, like a, you know, I guess a 60s or 70s computer. And I was intrigued that the rotary dial was being used for something that was not a telephone. And it would be cool to make an instrument, but I couldn't think of a good way to apply it. And Leon came up with the idea of, you know, a lot of even modern electronics respond to numbers of clicks of a switch, like a CD player. You press the thing 7 times and you get track 7. So because a rotary dial is nothing but a switch that's being switched on and off by a prefigured amount with the dial, you could do that. So he hooked up a rotary telephone switch to the CD player switch, and then you could dial in the track with the dial. So he made some electronic timers that you could then, whatever number that you dialed in would wait, you know, a certain amount of pulses from an oscillator. If it was every six, it would only trigger at every six. And of course, you can assign different numbers to the different things that you can trigger. And then you get enough of those going and you can get some kind of funny polyrhythms and things. So that's an extravagant instrument. We've only made two of them. There's a bigger, more elaborate one over at his house. That's the newer one. We also made it so that it could be dismantled into three sections and packed into suitcases in case we needed to fly with it. We did fly once with the old dual primate console. And that was when, well, Joe was interested. Joe at Pierogi, he's the Joe Amrine, runs Pierogi Gallery. He asked about, liking the stuff with the synthesizer, saying, would you consider doing something at the gallery? And then I thought of doing something that, rather than a performance instrument, which is what we're doing, something that hangs on the wall and is kind of an edifice, but that spits up a sound every once in a while, but at irregular intervals that always change. And the point of reference is kind of like a striking clock, like a grandfather clock that chimes the quarter hour, that you have these periodic sounds, only in this case, they're not at regular intervals. They're always at different intervals, and you can control how often or seldom it occurs, but you don't control the actual interval. So he came up with, you know, some timers that can knock each other around, like a random number generator. You have a deterministic procedure that does something complex enough you perceive it as random or unpredictable, even though it actually is predictable. So we made about a dozen of these things and had them mounted on the wall. And at the opening, which was New Year's Eve, at the beginning of 2006, five going into six, and we were working like crazy to get the thing done on time, and I was down in my shop and cutting all this medium density fiber board, and I was too dumb to wear a mask, and I didn't know how powdery and fine that dust is. It's really nasty dust, much worse than cutting plywood or something like actual wood. So we got it all done, and we had it all set up, and I tweaked up their settings so that they would do a nice chance kind of contrapuntal thing. You get them all doing something seldom, but since they're all going, this one goes off and that one goes off, and sometimes one after another, and so there are all sorts of patterns that just are created. And so I had it tweaked up all nice, and then I went home to get a tool, you know, four blocks away. And when I came back, it was funny, there were all these people standing at them like they were one-armed bandits, and the whole place was full of loud, continuous noise. And what was funny was later people were saying, like, that was the best interactive exhibit I've ever seen, and we didn't even intend for it to be interactive like that. We knew that people would touch it and that they would monkey with it, but they weren't really supposed to. We figured that people would think, oh, you're not supposed to touch. But once somebody sees one person doing it, then you got two people, and then the example was you stand at these things and all the controls are unlabeled. But people would find the volume knob right away and turn it way up, and it would just go, and there was just this incredible din. But people were having so much fun, and so it was this great New Year's Eve thing where there was this unbelievable din, but you couldn't tear people away from them. And what was really amazing to me was, you know, when people see the dual primate console, people are intimidated by it. They look at all the unlabeled controls. How do you know where anything is? And I said, well, we made it so we know where it is and we're familiar with it. And if you see this row, it's really identical to the other rows, so you know that it's the same for each row, just independent. And, you know, we know the oscillators are here and we know the envelope generators here, that group of four. And even just knowing that those are four things that belong together, you see a group of four, you know, like if you're familiar with analog synthesis stuff, this stuff becomes familiar. But if people don't have a framework for it, it's just incomprehensible. So people, without trying to play it, would say, like, "What? How do you know where anything is?" And have this anxiety projected onto it. But you put the thing with unlabeled controls on the wall. Now it's not an instrument. Now you don't have the anxiety of, oh, I'm not allowed to touch a musical instrument that I don't know how to play. And people felt free, because it was not perceived as an instrument. There was no expected expertise. And so it was so funny how people were just all over them and turning the knobs and finding out things and having a whale of a time. So I felt badly for the gallery people because there was a ton of noise for the whole month and they're trying to get the work done in the back room. And eventually Leon did replace the switches. There are some switches that you could turn to just let it go all the time. When you're creating a sound, you're trying to make the oscillators knock each other around. You want to hear what they're doing. Then you shut it off. And then it just goes, and you hear a little section of whatever it's doing. And then it's silent the rest of the time. But people would turn on that switch and leave it on. And then walk away. So the thing is just going all the time without any articulation. When it's really only supposed to articulate once in a while. So then he swapped out the switches with momentary switches that you have to hold up in order for it to go all the time. And then you let go of it and it turns off. So that helped to make it more humane for the gallery people. And then we did another show out in Leipzig when Pierogi had a gallery out there. Well, that was when we tried to fly the dual primate console out. And I made a big crate for it. And it cost so much money to get it out there, more than it cost to fly a person there and back. And then it had to be ended up, it landed at some other airport, and we had to get in a car and go to some faraway place and go through the security, and they were all suspicious of it. And then they stuck a sticker on it, which made me mad at first, but now I'm glad that there's a cool East German sticker